Today on Dana's Low Carb for Life, I'll tell you how to smoke a perfect slab of ribs, review Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Body, and we have another installment of Low Carb Voices, so stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey gang, welcome to episode 18 of Dana's Low Carb for Life, brought to you by CarbSmart, your smart choice for a low-carb lifestyle. First of all, I've heard from some of you that you have the new expanded 15-minute cookbook, 300 15-minute low-carb recipes. Everybody seems to like it. I'm so thrilled. Please, if you have the book and like it, could you please go to Amazon.com and post a review? There's no reviews yet. If you hate the book, don't bother. We'll throw up a link at the show page, danaslowcarbforlife.com, so you can find the book easily at Amazon. I'm going to talk about one of my favorite foods today, spare ribs. I love spare ribs. I'm going to tell you also some of what I've been finding out in a new bestseller called The 4-Hour Body by Timothy Ferriss, and we are once again going to have an installment of Low Carb Voices. You're going to want to hear that. We've got a couple of great calls. But first, let's talk about spare ribs, shall we? As I'm recording this, it is the day after Memorial Day, 2011. And you know what the day after Memorial Day means? It's summer. Yeah, and it's certainly acting like summer around here. Forget all that stuff about summer running from June 21st to September 21st. Here in the States, we all know that summer is really Memorial Day to Labor Day. After all, Miss Manners will now officially sanction your wearing white shoes, so it must be Memorial Day. Plus, the local pool just opened. All of this means that cookout time is upon us. I thought, therefore, that it might be seasonally appropriate to give you the lowdown on how to turn out a rack of spare ribs that will make grown men weep, or possibly even propose. At first glance, a rack of spare ribs would seem ideal for us low-carb types, but there is this problem with virtually all commercial barbecue sauce. It's sugary. It's really, really sugary. Often you will get as much as 12 to 15 grams of sugar in a 2-tablespoon serving, and very few people stop at just 2 tablespoons. So it's going to behoove us to learn how to turn out fabulous barbecue at home instead of going out for it. It also, is, of course, is way cheaper. Now, I've always been a good cook, but until I learned the difference between grilling and true barbecuing, I would try to grill my ribs, and I invariably cremated them, which was heartbreaking. It took me a while to figure out how to turn out good ribs, and I thought maybe some of you are having the same problem. Well, then I learned how to slow smoke my food, and now my ribs turn out succulent, smoky, and delicious every single time. So, here's the lowdown. First of all, you need to remember that slow-smoked barbecue takes time. This is not a quickie supper. You're going to need to be around all afternoon. Barbecuing is absolutely perfect for a Saturday that you spend puttering around the yard or catching up on chores. You know, any kind of little work that you do around the house that'll let you take a break every half an hour to tend to your barbecue. Figure it's going to take you 5 to 6 hours for your average slab of ribs. You can use, by the way, the same method that I'm going to describe on other kinds of meat. It'll take 7 to 8 hours for a pork shoulder, maybe 3 to 4 hours if you want to do some turkey legs, or an hour and a half to 2 hours for chicken that has the skin on and the bone in. I wouldn't try slow smoking boneless, skinless chicken breast. You're going to get leathered. You will need wood chips. This is important. You need wood chips to make smoke. That's where the smoky flavor in your slow smoked barbecue is going to come from. I get my wood chips either at Kmart or at a local hardware store called Bloomington Hardware. Most hardware stores discount stores are going to carry bags of wood chips. Now, there's a variety of chips out there. You can get mesquite chips, you can get applewood chips, you can get all sorts of chips, hickory chips. I've even occasionally bought chips made from old Jack Daniel's barrels. Yep. Quite honestly, I have to tell you, I can't tell a lot of difference in my finished barbecue from what kind of chips I'm using to smoke them, but maybe you've got more sensitive taste buds than I do. Just, you know, buy whatever chips appeal to you. Get an old coffee can or a big bowl and throw a pile of your wood chips into it and fill it up with water and let them sit by the grill. They got to soak for a good hour or two before you start cooking. I tend to leave my bowl of soaking chips out by the grill all summer long, dumping the water off of it periodically to kill the baby mosquitoes. This is up to you. You need a grill that has a lid to hold the smoke in. I prefer a propane grill just because it's vastly easier. Start your fire on just one side of the grill. Either pile the charcoal all at one side or turn on only one burner if you're using a propane grill. Then you put a disposable aluminum pan under the grill on the other side for drippings. Okay, that's going to be your drip pan. And it does need to be under the grill rack. Close the lid to let your grill heat. You're also going to need an oven thermometer. You can get these at any grocery store, housewares aisle, or at, you know, Kmart or Target or whatever. Stick this in your grill before you close the lid. This is going to let you know when your grill is up to temperature, obviously. Now, you need some dry rub. You can buy dry rub. Often it has sugar in it, so read the labels. But dry rub is super easy to make. You just measure some spices into a bowl and stir it together. A good basic rub is a quarter cup each of black pepper and paprika, 3 tablespoons of Splenda, or you could use erythritol or whatever your favorite sweetener is to equal 3 tablespoons of sugar, 2 tablespoons of salt or Vegisal, 2 teaspoons of dry mustard, and 2 teaspoons of cayenne, less if you don't like your food hot. This rub will have 1 gram of usable carb per tablespoon of rub. But there are a ton of rub recipes out there, as I discovered when I started writing barbecue book. And most can be decarbed by simply swapping Splenda or erythritol for the sugar. And, you know, you may want to swap out a few other things, too. You'll have to look. When the fire is ready and the grill is at a temperature of 225 degrees, that's Fahrenheit for those of you who are out of the country. You might want to look up the Celsius conversion. You put your rack of, I forgot to tell you. You have your rub. What you want to do is now sprinkle it liberally all over both sides of your rack of ribs. Bad idea to leave that step out. Sprinkle it liberally over both sides. In fact, you can do this before you even start your fire, and that will give it a little time to settle into the meat. So when your fire is ready and the grill is at 225, you put the food over the drip pan on the grill and put a piece of aluminum foil on the grill right over the fire on the other side where it's going to get hot. Throw a big old handful of those soaked wood chips on your piece of foil. Then shut the lid of the grill to hold in the smoke. That's it. You've got your dry rub on your meat. You've got your smoke fodder sitting there on the aluminum foil smoking. Now, you're going to need to add more chips to your fire every 30 minutes or so throughout your cooking time or whenever you notice there's no smoke leaking out of your grill. If you're using a charcoal grill, you are also going to have to add more charcoal as the charcoal burns down to keep the fire going for that 5 to 6 hours. This is the whole reason I broke down and bought a propane grill, because I wanted to be able to slow smoke things without having to keep adding more charcoal. Now, you still have some rub left, I hope, because what we're going to do next is mix 1 to 2 tablespoons of your barbecue rub, your leftover barbecue rub, with a half a cup of water or broth or light beer. I would use chicken broth or light beer. Plus, you want a half a cup of olive oil or melted coconut oil or some other kind of oil. This is a mop. We call this a mop, and it's a basting sauce. This is what's going to keep your barbecue moist and keep on building layers of flavor during that whole smoking time. So let your meat smoke for a good half hour before you mop it for the first time. You don't want to just mop off all of that rub you just put on it, okay? If you mop it too soon, you're going to mop off all the rub. Then, once the first half hour is up, just baste your meat every time you add more chips to the fire. Do use a tongs to turn your ribs over and baste both sides, and that way you'll get a more even smoking too. This process of adding more chips and mopping your meat should continue for, like I said, 5 to 6 hours, until the meat is pulling away from the ends of the bones, which, as I've already stated, will, you know, take a long time. It is worth it, worth it, worth it. Especially, again, you know, you're mowing the lawn, you're doing the laundry, whatever it is you do on a Saturday. Okay, your time is almost up. Your ribs are almost done. Your ribs are getting irresistibly tender. You can barely resist just picking them up in your hand, burning your hand, and shoving them in your face. In the last 20 minutes of cooking, this is the time to coat them with what we call finishing sauce. That's what most of you call barbecue sauce. Technically, that's called a finishing sauce. And it's important to know that it is a finishing sauce because if you put your sauce on at the beginning of cooking, it'll turn black and nasty. It's gonna burn. So that's why it's a finishing sauce. So if you want barbecue sauce on your ribs, 20 minutes before they're done smoking is the time to put it on. Most commercial barbecue sauce is nearly as sugary as pancake syrup, as I mentioned. So it's a good idea to purchase low-sugar barbecue sauce. CarbSmart carries a few. Or you can make your own. Take a look at my low-carb barbecue book for lots of ideas. There's also a good barbecue sauce and 500 low-carb recipes. I've posted one of my best barbecue sauce recipes on the show page at danaslowcarbforlife.com to get you started. But chances are that your favorite barbecue sauce recipe will adapt pretty easily if you use no sugar added ketchup in place of the ketchup that's often in barbecue sauce. And, of course, swap out any sweetener in it with your favorite low-carb sweetener. Most of the barbecue sauces I have tried to adapt have come out well. Other things you can try, you can use sugar-free pancake syrup if you want to get a maple note in there. If you want an orangey note, often I've seen barbecue sauces that have a citrus thing going on. I would probably use lemon juice, sweetener, and some orange extract to get that note. There's all sorts of ways to sub in a barbecue sauce, but it's really pretty easy. If you're in a pinch, it is helpful to know that there's a brand called Stubbs Barbecue Sauce. It's a regular grocery store brand. It's widely distributed, and it's got sugar in it, but it's got about half the sugar of most of the competing brands of your Casey Masterpiece and your Bullshot and your, your Kraft, whatever. If you stick to just a little of the Stubbs, you should be okay, so long as you're not on induction or really carb intolerant. And it's really very, very good. We use the Stubbs around here just to have on hand. That's it. That's your barbecue. Grab your ribs off the grill, slap them on a platter, and serve them up with a whole bunch of napkins, of course. And a nice side of unpotato salad, a plate of sliced ripe tomatoes. You've got the perfect summer feast. Enjoy. But one more thought about those spare ribs. Because I deliberately try to get 75% or more of my calories from fat, I'm always on the lookout for fatty meat. This is not always easy, since the meat producers have, for a couple of decades, in response to fat phobia, been breeding their stock to be leaner and leaner and leaner, and the grocery stores are trimming it closer and closer and closer. However, spare ribs are pretty reliably a fairly fatty meat, which makes them a preferred cut for me. All issues of how tasty spare ribs are aside, I prefer them because they are fairly fatty. I make them in the winter in the oven. And pork, by the way, despite being a nutritional pariah in a lot of circles, is actually super nutritious stuff. It's a particularly good source of thiamine, niacin, and potassium. Yes, potassium. You don't need to eat bananas. You can just have some ribs. And frankly, I'd rather have ribs than a banana any day. So that's how to come up with a great slab of ribs. And I hope you'll have a barbecue this coming weekend. Okay, let's move along. In a few minutes, we're going to have another installment of Low Carb Voices. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about this book I've been reading. I had, you know, holiday weekend like everybody else. So over the weekend, I sat out in the sun we finally got here in southern Indiana. And I started reading The 4-Hour Body by Timothy Ferris. After all, I liked his 4-Hour Work Week, although I haven't achieved a 4-Hour Work Week yet. So I thought I'd read The 4-Hour Body. Now, I haven't been reading The 4-Hour Body all the way through. Indeed, Mr. Ferris recommends that you read his book piecemeal, that you look at the parts that fit your needs and read those and dip into the book as your own personal agenda dictates. The book is an interesting hodgepodge of weight loss and fat loss advice, workout programs and exercises, health tidbits, how to get more out of your sleep, Even quite a lot of explicit sexual advice and techniques, complete with diagrams in some cases. If you're easily shocked, you might not want this. Ferris is a compulsive self-experimenter, a trait with which I empathize. Ever since I started sticking holes in my pinkies to see if various foods were as low-carb as they claimed they were. Mr. Ferris is also a big proponent of the 80-20 rule, only he takes it further, saying that as little as just 2.5% of efforts will yield 95% of results in a lot of the cases. And he claims that his book contains that small body of information that will yield disproportionately big results. He claims he's got the 2.5 to 3% that will give you the 90 to 95% of the results. That's a heck of a claim. First, of course, I have read everything Ferris had to say about fat loss, having had a problem with this all my life. I thought that was what I wanted to read. His recommendations are great for those who are not seriously carbohydrate intolerant. I really think his information is colored by the fact that he is a healthy young man in his early 30s who has never had a serious obesity problem. And what works for someone like him doesn't necessarily work for those of us who were on Weight Watchers by the time we were 11. But I think for people who have just put on a few pounds since they've grown up, his advice is good. He recommends cutting out all carbs that are white or can be made white. In other words, whole grains are out along with the refined grains. I thought that was interesting. I liked his could be made white. He bases his meal on proteins, vegetables, and legumes. Ferris said he needs those legumes to keep the calorie count of his meals high enough without spiking blood sugar. He refers to it as a slow-carb diet. And again, for a man in his early 30s with no existing blood sugar trouble, this should be pretty effective. Mr. Ferris also cautions against eating fruit, which is controversial advice for which I commend him, because fruit has gotten a good reputation it really doesn't deserve. However, I'm not likely to try Ferris's slow-carb diet. It's just too much carbohydrate for my own personal body. I prefer to get my calories from fat, as I've mentioned. Like I said, I aim for 75% of my calories from fat, except on days when I have a couple of glasses of wine, when alcohol calories skew that percentage, but still I'm getting 70 to 75% of my food calories from fat, and generally 5% or less of my calories from carbohydrate, almost every day. Two, Mr. Ferris recommends one cheat day per week when A, you give yourself permission to eat anything you want, even the most egregious carby junk. He talks about eating bear claws and Nutter Butters and like that. And B, on the cheat day, you're supposed to spike your calories way higher than you usually eat. He says this will keep your metabolism from dropping, from down-regulating, from a reduced calorie load, and will actually result in greater weight loss over time. Now, he may be right about that, especially in the context of a low-calorie diet. However, I should also add, Mr. Ferris does not recommend, even on your non-cheat days, restricting calories necessarily. He says that you should eat enough at each of your meals to not be hungry until the next meal. However, I see a huge problem with this whole cheat day concept for us. Over and over, I have heard from people who have done really, really well on a low-carb diet, lost a bunch of weight, improved their health, until the day they decided they could cheat just this once. Oh, it's the holidays, or hey, I'm on vacation, so they eat the cookies, the potatoes, the bread, the house specialty dessert, the sugary cocktail. The next thing they know, they're hoovering down every carb in sight and back where they started or even several pounds higher. Well, there may be some people who, if they know they can splurge every Saturday, that helps keep them on plan for the rest of the week. But for a lot of us, those of us with seriously broken carbohydrate metabolisms, we're talking about an addiction problem. I mean, you know, the only substance I ever stole to get was sugar. I don't know anyone who recommends a Saturday night bender to a recovering alcoholic. Again, this advice seems best suited to people who aren't badly carbohydrate intolerant to begin with. However, that calorie spiking thing sounds interesting. I have also read of what's called calorie cycling, a plan by which you deliberately alter your calorie intake pretty radically from day to day, and it requires keeping track. The idea is that you eat, say, 2,000 calories one day, only 1,300 the next, and then up to 1,700 and down to 1,500 and then back to 2,000 and so on. The idea is that your body doesn't get used to one constant level of calorie intake and thus never downregulates metabolism. But if I'm not going to eat junk, and I'm not going to eat junk, how am I supposed to spike my calories once a week? What am I supposed to gorge on? As you may have noticed, once you started low-carbing, there is a limit to how much fat and protein you can eat without feeling too full to continue or even feeling sick. Now, again, the calorie spiking thing is interesting, but I'm going to backburner this recommendation for a while and see if my brain comes up with a good idea. There are some tips in the book, however, that I am trying out, and I thought I'd let you know what those are. First of all, Mr. Ferris, along with a whole lot of experts I respect, is a big proponent of eating breakfast within an hour of arising. I have not been doing this for a while, partly because for a while I was doing a mild version of intermittent fasting. I would quit eating by 8 p.m. and not eat again until 11 or so the next morning, an approach, I might add, that did not really make me lose any weight. Intermittent fasting didn't do a whole lot for me. And partly because by the time I take a shower, dress, drink my tea, read the paper, and do my phototherapy, which is to say I expose myself to sunlight on sunny days or to a phototherapy light box on gloomy days for at least a half an hour, 45 minutes, and often for an hour. So by the time I do all of that, at least an hour has gone by. So I'm now making an effort to eat breakfast no longer than 1 hour after arising. We will see what we will see. If I find myself losing weight, obviously I will let you know. Ferris also talks about the fat-burning effects of cold, that by exposing yourself to cold, you can burn fat. This, he says, is why swimmer Michael Phelps needs to eat a reported 12,000 calories per day. Because along with the calories he obviously burns exercising, he also loses thousands and thousands of calories to the water, because water, as you may have noticed, sucks up a lot more heat than air does. Ferris actually tried sitting in baths with a couple of bags of ice in them, like up to his waist and then later deeper. He says this worked to burn a whole bunch of fat, but that it was just as painful and gruesome as it sounds. Doesn't sound like anything. I don't want to lose weight that bad. I don't know about you. Ferris also recommends cold showers for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. But even that sounds pretty unappealing to me. However, he does have some less painful methods for getting some of the benefits of cold exposure. He recommends that you drink at least a half liter of ice water upon arising, and says this will immediately increase your metabolism by 25 to 40% for an hour or two, at least. And he also recommends placing an ice pack on the upper back and neck for a half an hour or so in the evening. Both of these seem very doable. I've been drinking ice water when I get up, and just today I bought one of those gel packs you can put in the freezer for ice therapy. That's shaped specifically for doing the neck and shoulders. I plan to use this most evenings at any rate. Again, I will let you know how it goes. Ferris also has a section on damage control, how to minimize the weight gain expected from that once a week binge. And it mostly has to do with limiting your blood sugar reaction to it. Again, that's all well and good for folks with a robust carb metabolism, but that ain't me, nor, I suspect, is it you. If you want to eat carbs, say, on Thanksgiving or whatever, then you might look at Ferris's recommendations for minimizing the damage. There is one trick in that section, however, that seemed worth trying even without doing a binge day and eating a bunch of carbs. Ferris recommends 60 to 90 seconds of exercise. He does air squats and wall push-ups, but says really any kind of muscle contractions will do, right before eating, and 90 minutes after eating. This, he says, activates an enzyme called GLUT4, which is a glucose-transferring enzyme, to come to the surface of the cells and take calories into your muscles rather than leaving them to be stored. That's easy enough. You know, it's easy enough to do 60 to 90 seconds worth of exercise right before I sit down to eat. He says he eats out twice a day and that he just goes into the men's room, into a stall, and does, you know, 60 seconds worth of squats and another 60 seconds worth of wall push-ups, and he's done. It's easy enough, and I'm trying this. And again, we shall see. If in a month I'm considerably smaller, I'll let you know. There is a whole lot more in this book. Way, way more in this book. And I have not read it all. After all, it is a 600-page book. You'd expect there to be quite a lot in there. There are some interesting workout programs. There's some stuff about how to rehab injuries. There's just a lot of really interesting stuff. One non-diet-related piece of info I really feel I should pass on. This is completely tangential to the whole subject of low-carb dieting, but Ferris claims that cell phone radiation reduces sperm count dramatically, and that he saw a big jump in his sperm count and testosterone levels when he stopped carrying his cell phone in his pocket right next to his genitalia. Gentlemen, take note. The 4-Hour Body is, I have to tell you, a super fun read. I really like the way Ferris writes. He's very entertaining. He's very clear. And it really has something for everyone. I would recommend it. Again, it's not the kind of book you're probably going to read cover to cover, but there's going to be something in there that's interesting for everybody. And I haven't even read the whole thing yet. So there we go. Now, we're going to get to low-carb voices. Yay! We didn't do low-carb voices last week, and I missed it. First, we're going to hear from Jeremy. And Jeremy wants to know about blood glucose values. He just bought a glucometer. Give it a listen.
Hey, Dana. This is Jeremy from Arizona. And with all this talk lately of testing blood sugar, I'm new to low-carb since January. I decided to go out, and I just purchased a glucose meter. But still kind of a mystery, like what should a low carber's numbers be? You talk about your fasting. Does that just mean you do it when you wake up in the morning? Anyway, if I could get a rundown of that, that would be awesome. Thanks for the show. It's fantastic. And low carb for life.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for calling. This is a great question. I think you're going to find that despite that whole sticking holes in your pinkies thing, which isn't the most fun, the whole blood glucose meter thing is fun and even kind of addictive at times. You'll be like, well, what's my blood sugar now? I get in that mode sometimes. Yes, your fasting blood glucose is your blood glucose first thing in the morning when you get up, or technically, any time you haven't eaten for at least 8 hours, but then I rarely go 8 hours without eating when I'm awake. Your fasting blood glucose should be between 70 and 100. Anything over 100 is getting hanky. Between 100 and 125, you're considered pre-diabetic. Over 126, you're in the diabetic range. Thank God I've never seen mine higher than 125. You can also use your glucometer to find out which foods mess up your blood sugar and which don't. If you take a reading right before you eat, and then you take readings every 15 minutes thereafter for 3 hours, this, by the way, is where cheap test strips are nice, you can get a really good idea of whether a food is okay for your body or not. If there's a food that you're just not sure about, this is a really good thing to do. I have also used this method to determine if low-carb specialty foods are really as low-carb as they claim they are. By the way, if you want to do this, testing the low-carb specialty foods, it's good to know that 1 gram of carb should move your blood glucose up no more than 5 points. So if, say, you get a 25-point rise in your blood glucose total, you can figure that food had about 5 grams of carbohydrate in a serving. 2, Dr. William Davis, who is a cardiologist and a big low-carbohydrate diet proponent, says that keeping track of your postprandial glucose is the most important number you can track. He says that your blood sugar should be no higher than 120 by 1 hour after eating, and that it's really, really important to check this, you know, off and on, especially if you eat a meal you're not sure about, to check your blood sugar an hour after you eat and make sure your blood sugar isn't over 120. Any higher, you ate too much carbohydrate, and you need to not do that again. So I hope all this helps. This is a great question, and I'm really, really glad you called. Next, we have Kathy, and she's got a cooking tip. She called in with her favorite low-carb side dishes for Memorial Day, and obviously I'm a little late giving you those. Sorry about that. But there is a whole long summer ahead, so I thought they'd still be useful. Give it a listen.
Hi, Dana. This is Kathy from Arizona, and my favorite sides on Memorial Day will be jicama potato salad, jicama apple crisp, and your Bayou coleslaw. For the jicama, I actually cube it up and put it in the freezer and then take it out, put it in the microwave for a few minutes, and it gets soft. So I use it for many things. Hope to hear you talk about it on the podcast. Bye.
Kathy, that is so cool. I have never tried jicama and potato salad, or apple crisp for that matter. And I would be really, really interested to know, do you do something to get an apple-y flavor in there, or do you just season it with a sweetener and cinnamon and nutmeg and cloves like you would an apple pie, or what? Really interested to know that. Folks, for those of you who are interested, I just looked up the numbers. If you're going to make that jicama potato salad, 1 pound of potatoes has 82 grams of carbohydrate with just 7 grams of fiber for a usable carb count of 75 grams. And I've seen a lot of potato salad recipes that called for 3 pounds of potatoes. On the other hand, a pound of jicama has just 37 grams of carbohydrate, of which a whopping 20 grams are fiber. That gives us a usable carb count of 17 grams instead of 75. That is a heck of a carb savings. I am going to have to try this cubing the jicama, freezing it, and then microwaving it. Thank you for a really great idea, Kathy. See, I can learn things from everybody. Huh. So, okay, we need a Low Carb Voices question for this coming week. And seeing as right now I am sitting here sweating and drinking ice water while I talk to you, I want to know, what's your favorite low-carb summer beverage other than standard grocery store diet soda or water, both of which we all know about? We all know about Diet Coke, you know, we all know about water. So, but do you have another cool beverage for the summer? It could be alcoholic or non. That you'd like to let us know about. We'd like to know why you like it and where you get it, and bonus points if you can give us a recipe. Call 412-385-DANA. That's 412-385-3262, and let us know. If you have any friends you think might like the show, please steer them to the show page at Dana's Low Carb for Life. And if you like the show, how about leaving us a review at iTunes? We'd love to hear from you. Please don't forget to check out the blog at holdthetoast.com and join my Facebook fan page at Dana Carpenter's Hold the Toast Press. And if you just remember that Carpenter is spelled with a D where the T ought to be, you should have no trouble finding me. Of course, 315-minute low-carb recipes is now available at Amazon.com, or you can order it through CarbSmart.com along with any other stuff you want to order, like low-carb barbecue sauce. If you've already got the book and you like it, again, please, please go to Amazon and review it. That's it. And remember, till next week, stay low carb for life. This is Dana Carpenter saying thanks for listening. If you like today's show, please leave a review at the iTunes store. You can always leave questions and comments at 412-385-DANA or write us at feedback@danaslowcarbforlife.com. For complete show notes, please visit our site at www.danaslowcarbforlife.com, and don't forget to visit the blog at holdthetoast.com. Special thanks to Disc of Light Media and our sponsor, CarbSmart.com.